Right there. I remember him being a my mashkiach at Yeshiva University, our mashkiach, and he continues to be strong and continues to teach all of us. At those times, I helped start an Aliyah organization called Kuma, and Ari Bromowitz was one of the people that was in a certain kind of chabura, and him and other friends of mine, we all made Aliyah at the same time. And we're still, with that same impulse, making a difference here in the land of Israel today. Ari is one of the co-founders of the Land of Israel Network, and has done everything from television to running for the Knesset list, being on Fox, talking with Megyn Kelly about Iran, doing incredible stuff for the Jewish people. And now currently, and we'll talk about this in another second, part of the land, the reborn Land of Israel Network, or the continuing a generation of the evolution, where now it's also a broadcast network. His partner in crime, and also his commander in the army, is Jeremy Kimpel, Rabbi Jeremy Kimpel, who was this close to getting into the Knesset, became so important in Israel that they made a caricature of him on one of the famous comedy shows here, political comedy shows. We'd say he had a very high stature of notoriety here in Israel. On top of it, he himself, being a co-founder of the Land of Israel Network, everything from creating the Land of Israel necklace, which is just this incredible little thing that you carry on the Land of Israel with you wherever you go, these little pieces of sand from different parts of the Land of Israel, to inspiring myriads of people, including doing things like taking his family on an RV speaking trip. He takes his whole family to America and goes from north to south to east to west on an RV. And at the same time, and he sends us back pictures of his kids jumping into lakes all over, you know, beautiful America. And at the same time, he's inspiring Jews and Gentiles to a love of Israel, a connection with God and spirituality. And he's also really inspired a lot of us to think a little bit more deeply about our own spirituality. Myself, Yishai Fleischer, I am the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron. I hope you've been to Hebron. And not just to see me, but to see Mom and Dad, the founders of our peoplehood, the greatest revolutionaries who ever lived, and the people that God loved the most. And I've been privileged to work with these two gentlemen for a long time. Starting with have you ever heard of Arutz Sheva, Israel National News Radio, right? So we had a great radio station, and they were amongst the wonderful stars that were there. In any case, tonight we're going to talk about the future of the Jewish people. And before we get to the future, let's get to kind of understanding how we got here. Now, I could have easily prepped my friends with the questions that I was going to ask, but I decided that would be not challenging enough for them. So I have randomized and come up with new questions for them. And what I want to say to you is, before I get to the questions, we're not going to answer things overly technically, okay? We're not going to deal now with technicalities about, you know, land issues and rights and all kinds of issues that you can hear other speakers talk about. We're going to talk about a little bit broader strokes. We're going to challenge a little bit some of the fundamental assumptions that we have about the state of Israel in general. And that's what the atmosphere that I want you to get into. So I don't want to like nitpick at all kinds of factoids. I want to much more deal with the general essence of what we're doing here today. Because, my friends, we are dealing with something very big. Let's look around the room. We see pictures of the Jewish people's return to the land of Israel, and really the impulse of the third commonwealth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And these are big, giant questions. With that, I'll start with one of my first questions. Ari and Jeremy, Rabbi Ari, Rabbi Jeremy, Israel was started as a secular state. And this secularism, on the one hand, had incredible power to use the impulse of state building that was at the time that maybe Orthodox Jews were not connected to. But at the same time, it caused a tremendous rift, the reverberations of which we're feeling to this very day. Why did it have to start as a secular state? Why did that rift between Torah and Jewish ideas that sustained the exile for 2,000 years, why did they have to come into conflict with state building? Why did, shall we say, God, Why did Hashem start this incredible period through a secular regime which threw off at first the yoke of Torah, which is what the Jewish people are all about?
So I'm going to let Ari answer first. What I want to do is just give a little preface, and then I'll let Ari answer the actual question first. Because a lot of religious leaders, is it okay if I stand? It's better if I stand. As a religious Zionist, I believe Medinat Israel is Reshit Smichat Geulatim. It's like the beginning sprout of our redemption. I'm already not so excited to say Reshit Smicha. That sounds too beginning. It's the Reshit of the Geula. Almost all of the Jews are now in the land of Israel. Our economy is growing. Our military is the strongest force anywhere in the Middle East. Things are going on here that are unprecedented in Jewish history. This is the largest Jewish project that we've ever seen. Jerusalem has never been bigger, not in the times of David, not in the times of Shlomo, not in the times of the Maccabees. Something is going on here that's unprecedented. But then in the religious mindset, I've heard people say, but this was founded by not such religious Jews. This was a secular state. You're going to tell me that the beginning of the Geula is going to start with people like my grandfather who were doing pork barbecues on the beach on Yom Kippur in Kibbutz Degania? That's how the Geula is going to happen with secular Zionists? It doesn't make sense. That's not the way that I envision Mashiach coming. It can't be. So just to address that one issue, I think one of the most incredible marvels and wonders about Eretz Yisrael today is that the entire thing was spoken about in the times of the Navi thousands of years ago. And every single irrational thing that the Navi spoke about, today we see actually manifested. Just give two quick examples. In the book of Zechariah, it says that somehow thousands of years down the road from the time of Zechariah, a broken, smashed people will somehow trickle back to the land of Israel in the middle of really nowhere. This land was barren, it was wasted, it wasn't in Europe, it wasn't in the heart of Arabia. It was like an irrelevant, small, fractured people in an irrelevant, kind of in the middle of nowhere land. They're going to come back, and then all nations of the world are going to come against her. That's like, why would Zechariah, the audacity to make such a claim and to say, yep, I'm promising because I'm a prophet. And then to see that actually, how would the nations even all gather together in the time of Zechariah? With a pigeon? How would they do it? Like send out pigeon messages? There was no phones. How could it even possibly come to be a constellation of what he would say? And now we're actually seeing, what is it, Resolution 2334? The United Nations of the world are coming to this small fractured people that have returned to Eretz Israel. It's like so unbelievable that everything the Navi spoke about is happening. But here's the one about the secular Zionism thing, and I think this is critical. This is in Yechezkel chapter 36. וְלָקַחְתִי אתכם מִן הַגּוֹיִם וְקִבַּצְתִי אתכם מִכֹּל הָאָרָצוֹת וְהֵבֵאתִי אתכם אל אַדְמַתְכֵם. And I'll take you from among the nations, and I'll gather you from all the lands, and I'll bring you to your own soil. וְזָרַקְתִי עַלֵּיכֶם מַיִם טֵהוּרִים. And then I'll pour upon you pure water. וְטֵהַרְתֶם מִכֹּל טֻמֹּאֹתֵיכֶם. And I'll purify you from all of your tumah. וּמִכֹּל גִּלּוּיִכֶם הַטֵּרֶךֶם, from all your nonsense. וְנַתַּתִי לָכֶם לֵב חָדָשׁ וְרוּחַ חָדָשָׁה אֵתֵן בְּקִרְבֶּכֶם. And I'm going to put a new spirit within you, and I'm going to put a new heart within you. וַעֲשִׂיתִי אֶת לֵב הָאֶבֶן מִבְשָׁרְכֶם, וְנַתַּתִי לָכֶם לֵב בָּשָׁר. And then it continues to say, וְרוּחִי אֵתֵן בְּקִרְבֶּכֶם. And I'll put my spirit within you. וַעֲשִׂיתִי אֲשֶׁר בְּחֻקֹּתַי תֵּלֵךוּ וּבְמִשְׁפָּטַי תִּשְׁמֹרוּ וַעֲשִׂיתֶם. And then I'm going to make it that you're going to follow my commandments and fulfill my mitzvahs. So Yechezkel sees this incredible prophecy. The Jews are going to come back, and only then there's going to be a purification process. There's going to be a tshuva process. There's going to be a mitzvah rejuvenation in the land. So Yechezkel is saying, I want you to know, how is the Geulah going to unfold? It's going to start with people that literally have a heart of stone. That's what he says. Pork barbecues on Yom Kippur. The Zionist movement was a heart of stone, secular, anti-God. They were so mad at God after the Holocaust. It was like, we're done with you. A heart of stone. And now, the same kibbutz Degania? They're building Batei Knesset now for the first time in those kibbutzim. And so, I just want, on a theological, religious level, if you ever encounter a Satmar Chassid that says, but it's a secular country. How could that be? Yechezkel says, it's going to be a secular country in the beginning. And then a transformational process is going to happen, and Tshuva will occur. And now I want to get over to Ari to answer the question, then I'll answer the question after you.
I think you answered the question. I think that was quite a preface. How long am I standing? Okay. So, I'll tell you what a Jew... No, you're not. I'll tell you what a Jew in the exile is like to me. I don't like the word diaspora. It sort of smacks of a certain legitimacy, diaspora, like we're just dispersed around the world and we're scattered everywhere. Whereas exile has a connotation that we're not where we're supposed to be. So, a Jew in the exile, and I'm guilty as charged, born in Texas, not out of any decision that I made, but because the temple was destroyed, we were scattered around the world. That's where we are, and I defend all of you who are living in New York or you're in colleges around America right now coming here to Israel. Is that right? That you're sort of in that sort of fork in the road in your lives? Sorry? You made Aliyah. So we have a few Aliyah here already. So a Jew in the exile to me is like a fish that's flopping around on the riverbank, gasping for air, trying to breathe. And what's the memory span of a fish? Let's say it's 30 seconds. So the Jew in the exile has been gasping for air now for a minute and a half. He thinks this is what it is to be a fish. This is the life of a fish. And then someone comes and puts the fish back in the water. That's the return of the Jewish people back to the land of Israel. We're going back in the water and like, this is what it is to be a Jew. So I would take issue with the whole idea of what secular means. I think that the word secular, as we've been gone from this land for 2,000 years, has taken on a connotation having to do with the meticulousness with which we do the mitzvot, or even the mitzvot themselves. Are we doing, if we don't do the mitzvot, kehilchata, then secular Jews. But when you read through Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, are they saying you didn't check your property correctly? Are they saying you're not keeping Shabbat? Well, no, they say you're not being kind and compassionate, you're not loving your neighbor. They're speaking about the greater kindness and rachamim and love that we have for each other. Not about the meticulousness of the mitzvot, not that the mitzvot matters. But what's happened is, when we're in the exile, the mitzvot become an end in and of themselves. It's not part of a holistic life truth that it has, is slowly but surely becoming for me in the land of Israel. So, rather than saying it was founded by secular Jews, that Israel was founded by secular Jews, yes, perhaps they were having a certain rebellion against what they perceived to be the religious practices of their grandparents. I was working here for after we ran for Knesset together. I was working with the government, and there was a man named Rabinovich. And his grandfather was a great rabbi, and he was totally secular. And he said he came here to Israel to be an Israelite, not to be a Jew that slouched over his Talmud and pale and a victim. He's leaving that in the past, because in his mind, that's what being a religious Jew was. And he was leaving that whole thing behind. So it was a rebellion and a rejection of a false perception of what it is to be a Jew. But now the secular Jews that we perceive as secular, and by the way, if you walk around Israel and you ask many people, and this happens every time, we were just in the army 2 weeks ago, talking to our friends, oh, he's secular, I'm secular, he says. Well, do you keep Shabbat? Well, you know, I turn on the TV, but we make Kiddush, yeah, we make Kiddush, but I'm secular, but of course, Pesach, we have a Seder on Pesach. Yom Kippur, yeah, I fast, you know, I don't go to Shul. And these secular Jews are not all as secular as you would imagine. But also, when we were in the army in the Gaza war, they released us after 6 weeks of being in war, because that was the amount they were going to do another call-up. And we wrote up a petition saying, we volunteer to stay here and fight the war, just please let us finish the job. Let us go and wipe out Hamas. And the entire unit, minus that one guy, of course, signed this petition. And most of these people, secular Jews. They would be called secular Jews. Meanwhile, there are Jews that are living in Fairlawn, New Jersey, that at the very same time, I'm hearing about that when missiles are falling in on Israel, they're having a deep conversation about the way to separate the dishes between Chalav and Basar. And that's the conversation that's going on, rather than the missiles that are falling in on the Jewish people in the land of Israel. The bottom line is this. I'm going on. David HaMelech, where did he descend from? He descended from Lot and his daughter, so there was incest. Yehuda and Tamar, there was prostitution. And from that place came the redemption of Mashiach David HaMelech. Everything that's going on right now, it says in the Kabbalah that the chicken grows as the egg decays. We can look from the outside and perceive the founders of Israel as secular Jews, but when you look just a little bit deeper within, they came and they drained the swamps and they died of malaria and they had tremendous, tremendous mesirut nefesh, self-sacrifice and love for the Jewish people. To me, that's a religious Jew. When you're plugged into the welfare and the fate of the nation of Israel, then you're plugged into Hashem, and that's a true religious Jew. So I think that the definitions need to be redefined.
Excellent. Very good answers. I think I would add just one more thing, maybe, that there are processes, and the Jewish people after 2,000 years have forgotten action as an important characteristic trait. We were so mired in the galut, in bookishness, in defending ourselves in our ghetto walls, that we forgot what action was. We needed a kind of secular movement that was not locked into the books, not locked in to those ghetto walls. And it had to throw off certain yokes to be born again. And as it brought in back to the Jewish people the characteristic trait that had been lost since biblical times, which was the trait of action, that was what Zionism, secular Zionism, was all about. But today, religious Zionism and generally Israel, everybody here has bought into action. The Jewish world has bought into action. And therefore, that certain kind of klipa, that certain kind of husk that was necessary to awaken that characteristic trait has now fallen off. We've all accepted that. We all have a tremendous debt of gratitude to secular Zionism for bringing back that trait of action. And now we can kind of run with that and bring our Judaism into this fruit that emerges from that husk. Okay. So, Ari and Jeremy, I live on the Mount of Olives with very observant Jews, very observant Jews. They're called mustard, chardal, right? Charedi Lumi Jews. And they are nationalistic, and they are religious, but they also don't believe in going up to, on the Temple Mount. And they also don't believe in wearing tchelet, the blue fringe string on the tzitzit. And one of the my analyses of that is that they suffer from successful revolution. See, they're part of a great revolution. They've succeeded in it. Their families have made Aliyah. They are learning Torah and are Zionists. They live in tough places. But they're like, I'm done. Like, that's the revolution I wanted to achieve, and I got there. I also wanted to get my sons into the army. We did it. We broke through certain ceilings, and now we've done it. But I don't want the next revolution. I'm happy to park it right here. My revolution has been successful. And I wanted to ask you if you think that that's, you know, if that's fair, if that's a fair assessment of how they're looking at things, and if you could instigate the next revolution or evolution, revolutionary evolution, in the land of Israel, what would it be? It reminds me of this poster right here, and maybe Jeremy can explain that.
Yeah, about your Chardal friends. I think the question that everyone needs to ask themselves is, are we living with HaKadosh Baruch Hu present in our lives? That's really an important question. Because sometimes we may like be living a certain cultural reality, we may be living a certain ideological reality, we may have certain values that we hold dear, but the question is like, do we live with HaKadosh Baruch Hu present with our lives? Do we feel like he's a part of our lives? And if he's a part of our lives, then to me, if they follow this route that says, don't put your tchelet and don't do this and don't do that, that's like technicalities. But the real question is, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a part of our lives, where would HaKadosh Baruch Hu really want us to be? What would he want us to do? What would be the next revolution? So we talked about the change of the secular Zionists. So Judaism is alive. Anything that's alive is always changing. That's the definition of being alive. It's growing, it's dying, it's growing, it's falling, leaves are falling. Anything that's alive is always moving and changing. Our connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Am Yisrael is expressed today in a very different way than it was expressed 1,000 years ago. And it's expressed a totally different way than it was in the times of the Navi, when we had a Beit HaMikdash. So like, Judaism has evolved and changed, and it's always growing and it's always changing. What is the next change, I think, that needs to happen to the Jewish people? I would say that there's a few fundamentals. Inside Israel, so this was a poster that I helped design. And so it says, Mishanim Tfisat Olam. We're going to change a world, our world view. And it's sort of a play on words, because it's also changing our worldview, and it's also changing the world's worldview. And it says, "Ha'etgar haba shel hatzinut ha'elit," the next challenge of religious Zionism. And that's that until now, diaspora Jewry has pretty much built this country. The JNF supports us, Friends of the IDF supports us, Baron de Rothschild, meaning it was like the world Jewry that helped establish, build, and support the land of Israel. And now we're entering into truly a revolutionary time where it's time for the Jews of Israel to take responsibility for world Jewry. I go to shuls all over the world. And when I go there, when I see the Jewish lipometer, it's like barely ticking over 3. But when I come here to Israel, there's something about the air here. There's something about the Judaism here that's alive, that's pulsating, that's filled with energy. And that energy of Ki Mitzion, the Torah needs to go out. And now it's time, it's such an exciting time, that now there are religious Zionist Jews in Israel that are saying, yes, the next revolution is now Israel take responsibility for world Jewry. That's super exciting. And now I think that there's 2 other levels of what needs to happen. Obviously, the Jews of the exile need to make Aliyah. That's like, boom. I think that's just pretty obvious. And if like not now, then soon, and if not soon, then like almost. Like, there's no future outside of Israel, meaning the destiny of our people is unfolding in this city, period. There's no, the center of the Jewish future, that's always the most ridiculous thing that YUN, the center of the Jewish future. As if the center of the Jewish future is in Manhattan? I mean, the center of the Jewish future is literally on this street, here. This is where it's unfolding. This is where our destiny lies. That's why every shul around the world is facing this place. And so Aliyah is like baseline. But then after you make Aliyah, what are we doing then? Listen, I think that you can find our mission by what the world doesn't want. And it seems right now the world does not want us in Judea and Samaria. The world does not want us in the Mount of Olives. And if the world does not want us to live there, and that's like the whole world is gathering together to say Jews can't live in Judea, I think that probably our mission in the land of Israel isn't just to make Aliyah to Tel Aviv, but it's to actually specifically make Aliyah and move into Judea and Samaria and build it up strong. And then I would say one last thing, that I think it's actually time for us to step into the role that we were originally designed for. What is Am Yisrael actually created for? At least from what I read in the Tanakh, it's to be an Or LaGoyim. It's actually to be a light to the nations. Wouldn't that be amazing that instead of going like this, oh, Goyim, that we were like, oh, Goyim, I'm going to go teach them the Torah. I'm going to go teach them about the truth of Israel and the Jewish people. And we stepped up to the challenge now. And instead of cowering like we did for 2,000 years, because we had to, now that we're back in our land, we can actually be who we are and share the light. And when a Jew walks proud and talks proud to non-Jews, the non-Jew always respects us. Always. I've never seen a time when a Jew speaks proudly that the non-Jew isn't like, that is impressive. And so, 3 things. Aliyah, Israel, but not only Israel, Judea and Samaria, Israel, or East Jerusalem, Israel. And ultimately our mission is to like take it to the nations, to actually fulfill our role and change the world.
Can I sit down? I'll sit down. Okay. The revolution I would want to bring about isn't just me. I think this is deep within the hearts of the entire Jewish people. We're approaching the 50th year of Jerusalem. And what is the 50th year's jubilee? And what happens in the Yovel year, the Jubilee year? Freedom is exclaimed, the shofar of freedom is exclaimed throughout the entire land. And what do we really need to have freedom? Where is the freedom we need to have? Freedom in our heads, freedom in our hearts, and understanding that the only thing standing between us and building the Beit HaMikdash in quite a literal way is ourselves. We have total autonomy, control over all of this. The only thing is in our own minds. So when we're able to make that connection, but what allows us to make that connection? What allows us to really get rid of the fear? Well, Chazal tell us that fear is like idolatry. Why is fear idolatry? Because it's saying, I'm afraid something will happen that shouldn't happen, that I don't want to happen. But when we understand that everything that happens is in Hashem's hands, that the whole concept that we're here in Israel is a miracle. Every day that we're here is a miracle. I remember I'm in the army and I'm looking around and there's like 23 Arab states, 57 Muslim states, and I have a bunch of 18-year-old Israeli kids. We're so far outnumbered by the nations around us. Egypt alone has double the size of Israel's air force. Just Egypt alone. Every day that goes by in Israel is a miracle. The Six-Day War, they don't study it in West Point. You ask them why, they say here in West Point we study wars, not miracles. It's a miracle to begin with. So when we understand that everything is in Hashem's hands, then there's also no reason to have hate, because hatred and fear are these brother emotions. And the only reason we would hate these jihadists, these Arabs, is because we feel like they pose a threat. But when we understand that they don't actually really pose a threat to us, the only reason they're able to inflict damage on us is because we've allowed this fear to cause us to have this obsessive compulsion of constantly saying, Ma yomru hagoyim. What will the nations of the world say? We're so afraid. We feel on some level that we're here, living and existing in Israel, at the mercy and at the whim of the nations of the world. If we understood that, number one, nations don't have friends. They have interests. And Shlomo HaMelech understood this, which is why he made sure to have all the Merkavot, the strongest army in the whole region, in the whole world. Why? Because a strong Israel, militarily strong, is a peaceful world. And the only thing that's preventing us from doing that is our psychological codependence, for example, with American foreign aid. American foreign aid. Israel needs to say, no, thank you. We do not need this money. Number one, it creates this very unhealthy sort of, you know that book, The Giving Tree, where the kid is like chopping down the tree and he's left with a stump? Like, what kind of relationship is that? That's what we're setting up with America. And we're also crippling our own weapons industry, because rather than spending our own funds, investing it in our own weapons industry, and innovating and creating and selling and becoming a world global leader, we're getting these vouchers to purchase these American weapons, which we don't even want. We don't even want them anymore. The F-35 that we just bought that we're so happy about, America actually can ground it from America, meaning that they have control over the system in America. Talk about an unhealthy relationship. We don't even need it anymore. So why do we do it? Because we're so afraid of giving up that crutch and walking forward on our own. And it's the same thing with the Palestinian-Arab conflict. We hold on to this conflict for dear life, because we understand that we don't need to define ourselves by this. It's another among the many issues that we have here in Israel. And if we just deal with it correctly, it will be done, and we'll do it right. And we'll do it by our own morals and our own moral code and our own compassion, because no matter what we do, the world's going to come against us anyways. So if we understand we just move forward in faith and in truth, then we will be able to be truly free. Which is why I think the number one thing we need to do as a nation is to annex Judea and Samaria. Annex Judea and Samaria, and I'll tell you why that's the case. Because when the world is coming and saying Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria do not belong to the Jewish people, it's not the Mikre. What does the word mikre mean? It means coincidence. But you mix around the letters, it's rak Hashem. It's from Hashem that is the tip of the spear against the Jewish people. Why is Judea and Samaria what they're attacking? Because it works for them on so many different levels. Number one, a strategic level. Strategically, you know, there's a story about Bush and Sharon. Bush, the son, George W. Bush, in a helicopter with Ariel Sharon. They're overlooking Israel. And Sharon says, look, without the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, Israel is 9 miles wide. Bush says, 9 miles wide? We've got driveways longer than that in Texas. And I'm from Texas. I can tell you there are driveways longer than the entire width of the country of Israel without Judea and Samaria. We know exactly what would happen if we left Judea and Samaria. There would be missiles raining down on the entire nation of Israel, which is already the case. But it would be totally and completely indefensible. So that is the first phase in physically destroying the state of Israel and the Jewish people. That's number one. Number two, it undermines our very legitimacy. Our legitimacy to be here in the land. If we don't have a right to Hebron, then we don't have a right to Tel Aviv. If we don't have a right to Jerusalem, we don't have a right to anything. So when they're undermining our rights, we can say it's just words, but it's not words. The principle of the matter is the war in and of itself. That's what the entire war is about. Which is why what happened in Amona was so very deeply painful to me. It was so disturbing to me. Even though you could say, oh, they got a good deal in the end and they moved just a little bit here or there. Well, there is a leftist organization called Yesh Din that was funded by foreign governments They tracked down an Arab that they found after a tremendous amount of research, explained to him, convinced him that he had a claim, brought him, paid his legal bills to the Supreme Court. By the way, the Supreme Court in Israel is not democratically elected. 5 out of 9 of the people that determine who's on the Supreme Court are the Supreme Court themselves and other unelected lawyers. So it's a self-perpetuating, delusional leftist organization. And they ruled that because of this maybe-ish type of claim over 2%, right? Was it 5 out of 500 dunam? Was claimed, there was a claim against it. Any other country would have said, eminent domain, here's some sort of money. Worst comes to worst, destroy that 2%. Destroy the entire thing. The entire thing. And why was the entire thing destroyed? Because it wasn't about Amona. It's about the right of the Jewish people to be here in the land of Israel. Anywhere in the land of Israel. Which is why if they offered me $10 million to move my home on the hilltop in Judea 2 feet to the left, I would not do it. No way I would do it. Because I understand what it's about. It's about undermining our claim and our right to be here in the land of Israel. And the worst of it all is that they're dividing us up. It's this divide and conquer. That's what the attack is about. Why? Because now Fox Clothes or Tnuba Cheese, anyone that sells their products in Judea and Samaria is guilty of war crimes because this is all illegal and they can be boycotted. This is the companies not in Judea and Samaria, in Tel Aviv. They will be boycotted in Tel Aviv. If they sell their products to Judea and Samaria, they have to decide, is it to the world or to Judea and Samaria? And in the minds of many people that don't know better, they actually blame the Jews of Judea and Samaria in their minds for all of the conflict and hatred and anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism in the world. They blame it on them. And to wind it down, I would say like this. Jeremy and I, we did a show once. We called it Peace Now versus Hebron. We had a television show called Tuesday Night Live in Jerusalem. It was right next door. We had 600 people come to our shows. And we wanted to show that there's some sort of good, positive relationship that could be developed with the Jews of Peace Now to Hebron. So we went to the Peace Now rally and we said, do you have anything positive to say about the Jews of Hebron? They're like, a bullet for the Judeo-fascist. They're just spewing hate. The best thing about them, they know English well. That was the only positive thing that was said. Vicious, vitriolic hatred against the Jews of Hebron. So we said, what are we going to do here? This is like, we can't use this film at all. Then we went to Hebron and we said, do you have anything positive to say about the Jews of Peace Now? And the first guy we asked said, well, you know, Rav Kook explains that in the heart of every Jew, there's 3 different things. There's the Tikkun Olam, the desire for Tikkun Olam, love for the land of Israel, love for the Torah. And our brothers in Peace Now, they don't have the Torah, they don't have love for Israel, but they want to do Tikkun Olam, they're trying to bring us all together, there's something beautiful there. Another guy's like, they do all public relations for us, it's good. They all had something positive to say. But when we were in Peace Now, there was one question we asked that I think was the most revealing. We said, do you think we need more Jewish unity? Because I was thinking, Jewish unity, unity, it's liberal, it's fluffy, who's going to say no to Jewish unity? Every single one of them said no. They all said no. Why? Because what does unity mean? That we as the Jewish people have something that differentiates us, that makes us a unique group that is different and separate from the rest of the world. And they don't want to be different and separate from the rest of the world. It's not the Jew of Hebron that they hate, it's the Jew within themselves. Because deep down, every Jew has this desire for universal brotherhood, but if they understood that the way to bring the world together is by embracing our Jewish culture, our Jewish identity, our Jewish values, who we are as Jews, that I think the entire Jewish people would be coming together. So really, annex Judea and Samaria, and number one, Jewish education. Jews need to be coming to Israel and encountering our, the very essence of who we are as Jews.
Okay. So, we got a lot of revolutions that we heard about that could be done. Definitely very stirring. I want to say 2 more things before I get to the next question. First is that I want to recognize Hillel Van Leeuwen, Rabbi Hillel. Thank you so much for all your work in the organization. And thanks to the camera guy. What's your name, sir?
Avi, thank you very much.
Avi, toda rabba. Yofi samachnu. Avi's very pleased. Good. Now we're getting somewhere. Avi's a voter. He votes in this country, okay? The other thing I want to say is I'm going to ask 2 more questions, and then I want to open it up to you. So get them ready. And I'll ask the our two honorable gentlemen to keep it a little tighter, so that we can get to no worries, so that we can get to our young friend's questions. Now, one of the things that, both of you touched upon, Gentiles, and then you started talking about the Arabs and the Muslims and the Palestinians. Our region is seeing complete tumult. There's a war just a few clicks north of us, which has caused a refugee exodus of at least 1 million people. There's at least 1 million people right now that are displaced. There are untold amounts. It is a matter of debate, either 300,000 or 400,000 people dead. We're talking about a very serious bloodletting, including the usage of gas. We're talking about a proxy war between Shiite jihadism and Sunni jihadism. It's all happening all around us. We see ISIS. We see ISIS taking over North Africa. We see it taking over the Sinai province. We see it taking over in this new no man's land, ISIS land, between Iraq and Syria. The whole region's on fire. We see now here in Jerusalem an ISIS-inspired attack. And so this question is really about Cousin Ishmael. What's going on with Cousin Ishmael? As we're the startup nation and this beautiful shiny city, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Bechule, we see our own cousins, also children of Abraham, really imploding. So I wanted to ask you a general question. What's going on with Cousin Ishmael, and what impact does that have on us?
I think one of the best quotes from President Obama's last speech was, if Israel creates an environment where terrorism and violence are more likely, Israel has created the environment where terrorism and violence is more likely. It's truly miraculous. The delusions and hatred of Israel are just beyond any logic, beyond any morals. What's up with Cousin Ishmael? Boy, that's a big question. Lord, I don't have an answer to that one. I think that we have a responsibility to do what's right and what's moral. The last time the soldiers, this last pigua, there were 4 soldiers that were killed. Are you all familiar with this pigua? There was a massive rally in Gaza where they're waving Hamas flags and they're waving ISIS flags. And I posted on Twitter just to hear what people would say. And I said, would it be moral for Israel to just bomb the entire rally and kill all of those ISIS, Hamas-like supporters, members, the people that are waving flags as our soldiers are dead? Is it moral to just literally take a helicopter and just flatten that whole area and just take out all of those ISIS, Hamas guys? Is it moral or is it not moral? And that should be the only question we care about. That's it. What is the right, moral, just thing to do? That's all that Israel should care about. That's all Israel should focus on. And if we focus on what's moral and what's just with our Arab cousins, they'll actually, I think, step in line. And they're like, whoa, there's a sheriff in town. We can't just go persecuting Christians and crucifying these people and raping those people and the Kurds and just all of the chaos. It could be very well, if you look at the chaos that ISIS is creating, it's almost entirely over all of biblical promised Israel. From Israel all the way to the Nahar Prat. And it really could be that it's Israel's responsibility to be the sheriff in town. And to be like, we are going to make Seder. We're going to make morality champion here. Justice and compassion. And it could be that we are in a position now where we actually have to take responsibility and liberate the Muslim world from Muslim oppression. And that could be Israel's responsibility now. I'd be excited to take responsibility for the Muslim world.
I'm going to keep it short.
Brevity principle.
Okay. Apologize, I got carried away last time. I used to be full of a lot of hatred for the Muslim Arabs and the terrorists. And, we spoke about hatred earlier. and the idea that, you know, hating them is like when a man is beating a dog with a stick, and the dog is biting at the stick. That to understand there is a stick in Hashem's hand, and if we understand that, then we can look within and say, well, why is he using this stick against us? Is there some sort of message? Is there some sort of attribute, a national attribute within us as a nation, that if we look within and we refine that character trait, well, then it can really bring us in and neutralize the entire problem, where the problem doesn't need to exist anymore. And I want to read to you an unbelievable quote. This is a translation from an Al-Qaeda report from 2005. Are you ready? It says, God decided to test the Jews when they were still an oppressed people while still captive in Egypt. God seeks to lead them to the path of faith and victory, and therefore urges them to conquer the land of Israel. But the Jews are unwilling to make the necessary sacrifices to achieve the goal. To this day, the Jews have not learned that God grants victory only to those who struggle for victory. Throughout the generations, Jews, unlike Muslims, show that they do not fear God or recognize him as the moving force in the universe. Instead, they are more concerned with what man thinks. For this reason, the Jews find it easier to break the covenant between God and Abraham, which awarded the land of Israel to the Jews forever. That's from an Al-Qaeda report. Now, how many of you agree with certain parts of that? To understand what this is really about, is we need to understand just a few basic principles, and I'm gonna turn it over. Islam means submission. A fundamental tenet of Islam is global domination. And they divide the world up into two groups, Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam. The world of Islam, which is already under Muslim rule, and the world of Harb, which is the sword, which needs to be brought with the jihad under Muslim rule and converted to Islam, or Dhimmi under Muslim rule. And that's the way they don't believe in borders, they don't believe, that is how they divide up the world. And here they are expanding, and then this little tiny beat up battered nation of Jews, accountants, lawyers, not warriors, people from scattered around the world who don't even speak the same language, come back together and overwhelm them against great odds and return to our land. It's not about Judea and Samaria. They make this like it's about the West Bank, that's the whole issue. It's obviously not about Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria was liberated in 1967. The PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, was founded in 1964. Or that they founded in 1964 to liberate the settlements of 1967, which didn't even exist yet. Yasser Arafat wasn't, where was he born? He was born in Egypt. How is he a Palestinian liberation? What is this all about? The entire thing is a fiction. It's a fiction. And when we look within ourselves and say, we need to put our faith in God and do like Jeremy was saying, act with morality. That means that every Arab, every Muslim that is celebrating the murder of Jews on Facebook, that's inciting terror, that's a part of, throw them out of the country. It doesn't matter what the world says. Any rational nation would do such a thing. And we annex Judea and Samaria. There's a process just like in any country with which someone becomes a citizen. They have to take a vow of loyalty, and they have to not be terrorists that want to destroy the country. And if they're willing to do that, then they could be part of the Jewish people and part of the nation of Israel. And if not, throw them out. Then we can take down these fences. Then we can take down the walls. Then the Arabs don't need to fear for smiling at a Jew. An Arab doctor that's going by when there's a terrorist attack and children are lying there next to their dead parents, he can get out and help those children without being fired and put into excommunication by his entire community. We can uproot the evil within our midst and embrace those many, many Arabs with good hearts that want to be cousins and want to be friends. So we need to reach out to them with a hand of family and friendship and brotherhood, but that hand that's extended needs to be able to immediately be turned into a fist. And that's what they respect in my experience. They respect strength. They respect strength, and I don't care how this sounds. In some ways, it's like an ADHD child in the third grade wants a teacher not to be their best friend, but they want some sort of guidelines, some sort of boundaries. And if that's the way we need to be with them at the beginning, then we need to provide boundaries. But we need to do what we need to do in the moral way, to walk with Hashem, and to be a light to the nations of the world. Because let me tell you, the whole world is terrified of what we're facing here in Israel. There they call it Islamic terror, and here is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It's the same thing. And if we understand that the world is looking to us for leadership, well, then we can rise to the occasion. And having just been in the army, I can tell you that the Israeli army is like a lion ready to pounce. The People think that we're scared, that they saw the soldiers running during the attack. You give them one strong officer that gives a powerful, moving speech that we are the Jewish people. We're lions of Judah. We're back in the land of Israel. We will overcome enemies far beyond our amount when we understand that we're fighting not for Hashem, but Hashem is fighting through us.
Thank you very much. Okay, in the interest of time and to keep you guys awake, first thing, before I go on, I want to recognize world-class educator and the director of the Woke Mizrahi Movement, Rabbi Doron Peres. Rabbi, thank you so much for joining us today. And given that it's late, I want to turn it over to you a little bit. And remember, don't think small tactical here. Let's talk broad brush strokes. So direct your questions to me, and I'll redirect them. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we're speaking about acts in the West Bank. How's that one
Right, right, and I just want to remind everybody, as we say, questions right after that first statement. Okay, I can't say no statements, right?
No.
Should I give him space? Yeah. Okay.
No, I'm saying a statement, the question. So yes, we're coming in. I think a lot of people say you can't answer questions because of demographics. I think we all believe that that's not true. It's a lie. The Palestinian demographics has been a lie. So now my question is, what if it wasn't a lie, and what if there really, let's say, were 5 million Palestinians? Would we agree with the rest of the world that we have to give citizenship, or we have our own morality and our own way of dealing with it?
Okay, so the question is, in general, what rights do Palestinians, Arabs, are supposed to get under a regime of annexation, and of a hypothetical, which is, what if there were many, many more? Would you be concerned about that situation? Go ahead.
Okay, to be very brief about it, I'm in a current space where I vacillate on this issue, but where I'm standing right now at the core is I don't see the need to make them full voting citizens. I really don't. They can have all of the rights and the privileges, the medicine, and all of the reason that the majority of them would want to stay under a Jewish state, those reasons would still be there. But for a fifth column within the country to have, show me one Muslim country where a non-Muslim, I don't think I should be able to vote in Saudi Arabia. Why should I, as a Jew, be contributing to the nature and creation of a Saudi Arabian state? To me, Israel needs to be a democracy, but a democracy of Jews. And if the majority of Jews vote that we should have pork barbecues, God forbid, on the beach on Yom Kippur, then that's what it is. But to have a fifth of the country vote in, they want to destroy our very nation. They want to destroy the Jewish country. I see no reason why they should have to have voting rights. That simply, we're in a place right now where we're having to face our idolatry. And John Kerry said what many great rabbis of the past have said, that we're eventually going to need to decide, are we a democracy or are we a Jewish state? Which is our primary ideal and which is not? And I think that our primary ideal is we're a Jewish state, and then, which is the democracy of the Jewish people, and it doesn't make sense to me that the Arabs need to be able to vote to determine what the state of Israel is.
This is the catch-22 that Ari has, though. Because Ari says that as a democracy of Jews, that the Jews can decide democratically to eat pork on Yom Kippur on the beach. So today, the democracy of Jews has decided that they want to give everyone equal rights. So in the constellation that the will of the Jewish people today is that the state of Israel is defined as a democracy where everyone has pure rights. That's what the will of the Jewish people is today, correct? And so now
I wouldn't say that that's the will of the Jewish people because I don't think that they've been presented with all of the options. And what happens is they constantly vote in among the most right-wing politicians, and these right-wing politicians do the most left-wing things. They vote in Ariel Sharon and he gives away Gaza. I think that the nation is at a point when we were running for the Bayit Yehudi Party, they were doing all of these polls and it was showing that if only people under the age of 30 could vote, the Bayit Yehudi would have been the largest party in Israel. And I'm not talking about any individual party, I'm talking about the ideas that what does the Bayit Yehudi represent? That the Jewish people, the nation of Israel is in the land of Israel under the God of Israel. That's what it is, that we're a Jew, that it's a Jewish home. And I think that if we had a real candidate that presented a real coherent argument to the nation of Israel today, seeing the challenges that we're facing right now and they will be getting more and more in the future, more and more terrorist attack. We're not a totally insane people. We'll see the truth for what it is, and if the option is truly offered to us, because we had there was a Knesset member that was really making this case, and what happened? They banned him. He was not legal. They all voted to ban him because he was a threat to their seats. He was slated to get 12 to 14 seats. And every time that we're actually talking about the possibility of a fundamental revolution in how we see things, it gets too scary. It gets too nervous. What are people going to think? What are Jews in New York of us going to think? And what are the world going to think? When in reality, I think that they would respect it and they would understand it. That we're a Jewish state and Jews should be voting to determine the nature of the Jewish state.
I just want to say that if you study comparative democracy, you'll find many things about democracy that it's not a monolith. For example, in Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricans are not able to vote for the president of the United States. Nobody says that they're under apartheid. They have local voting, local rule, but they can't vote for the president of the United States because it's a territory. In Japan, if you move there, you can never practically get, if you're a white person, you can't get Japanese citizenship because that's a small island state that wants to protect its ethnicity. We're post-Holocaust people in an ethnic region. This is an ethnic country. And not necessarily do we want to hand out full rights to everybody, especially in the defensive state that we're in. There's a lot of people that want to use that democracy to undermine us. And I have a parable that works, I think. I came up with it recently. Oh, by the way, before I go on, I want to recognize Maxine back there. Maxine makes it all happen. Thank you so much, Maxine. God bless you. She's the spinal cord of Mizrahi here. I have a mashal that I like very much. I call it the mashal of the shrimp piece. Here in Israel, we still take hitchhikers. I take hitchhikers every day on the way to Hebron. And I want to make sure that those hitchhikers are comfortable, warm. I want them to be seat-belted. I want the car to be clean. And I want them to get to their destination. But I don't want to give them the steering wheel. Okay? Same thing with minorities living in our land. We want them to be well-adjusted minorities. I want them to be comfortable. I want them to be safe. I want them to get to their destination. But I'm not so sure that I want to give them the steering wheel. I think that's a parable. Let's go on to the next question, okay? And I'll be happy to take, I'd rather take a female, like to do male-female thing, if possible. Let's also think about questions about yourselves a little bit, because at the end of the day, I want to hear, did I ask you? I want to make sure that we're talking about our own life changes. Sometimes when we ask questions, we externalize the issues to like some kind of theoretical thing. But what about us? Because that's what really matters in this room, isn't it? What are we going to do? How are we going to change? Go ahead.
Until you guys made Aliyah, how did you guys keep the fire alive within you and Chutzlaretz?
Okay, so how did you keep the fire alive? I know the answer, but it's not legal. How did you keep the fire alive in your heart for Eretz Yisrael, for Torah, when you were a Jungerman out in the United States?
So just before you answer, can I just say one thing? I just have to apologize actually on my wife's going to sit because I pushed it as long as I can. So I just want to say to all of you, I really have to run now, a massive shout out to all of you for joining us. It's been an unbelievable day. I just want to thank also this incredible, and we apologize again for keeping you waiting. We really try to push it, the family came late. We pushed it as quickly as we really apologize. But to have Rabbi Yishai Fleischer, Rabbi Jeremy Gimpel, Rabbi Ari Abramovitz here, and this, the power of each one of these people individually together is unbelievable, and I think you're getting a sense of it here. And I want to thank you all. To my friend and colleague, Rabbi Jeremy Gimpel, I don't know if you mentioned, he's traveling to the Trump inauguration, but especially invited, is going to be speaking to the tremendously large gathering. Is it it's a faith thing, or is it just religious?
I think it's mostly going to be like a Christian Bible-believing concern, but there are going to be a bunch of rabbis there as well, but I'm the Israel guy.
He's going to be giving a drosha about Israel to massive supporters of Israel, so shkoyach of Jeremy. We'll chat some more before you leave. I really apologize that I have to run and that I came late. And shkoyach to the three of you, really, it's amazing. And guys, shkoyach, thank you very much. Avi Friedman, our photographer as well, has been amazing the whole day. There's and Rabbi will speak about Marion's book. And just to all of you, there is Sefa, thank you for being with us for the day. And sorry about that,
thank
guys.
You.
The question was, how did you keep the fire?
So I'll tell you how I kept the fire alive for me on an individual level. I think part of it was that I didn't first come to Israel until I was 16 years old. So for me, the thought that I was from Houston, Texas. There's like one kosher restaurant. The Hebrew language is relegated to black and white, Latin-like words. I felt like a monk sometimes when I'm in shul and I'm just saying words I don't know what they mean. Like it's like, and the thought of the state of Israel is like, I couldn't even wrap my mind around it. And then when I first came to Israel, I remember I was staring at a can of Coca-Cola. I couldn't take my eyes off it. I couldn't believe it that the Hebrew language is now written on a can of Coca-Cola. It went from the Torah, the old black and white scroll, to being written on a can of Coca-Cola. And the realization of the paradigm shift that was for me never left me. Even just now, we were in the war in Gaza. We were called up to the war in Gaza, and they were asking us to dig these trenches to divide, to protect this Jewish community with these Jewish kindergartens right behind us from Hamas. But meanwhile, there's like missiles landing all around, the mortars landing all over the place. And as we're digging these trenches, I'm thinking, how many times throughout Jewish history have we had to dig our own graves just to be executed into? And now we're able to dig trenches to defend the nation of Israel and the land of Israel, recognizing the miracle of what Israel is. And honestly, for me, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, influence was Yishai Fleischer. And I'm not just saying that as the honest truth. When I went to New York, I met Yishai. I had heard about him before, and he lit me up, and he helped me realize one of the most important lessons that I've ever understood in my life. What was it we were talking? He's like, what's happening and right now with the Jewish return to Israel? It's not just Aliyah. It's an Aliyah revolution. The world needs to understand it's an Aliyah revolution. And I'm like, okay, yeah, go tell the world, buddy, okay. And then he writes up like 5-6 posters, brings them to a Nefesh B'Nefesh arrival, hands them out, and the people are holding them up. And then I get a link. I'm Christiana, I'm on Paul, with CNN International. Tel Aviv, we have an Aliyah revolution. Oh my goodness, just the other day he's telling me, and I realized that the eyes of the world are on the Jewish people. They're waiting for us to speak up, and if nobody's doing it, even a scoundrel like me, who knows nothing, can actually stand up and be on Fox News and speak to the world, because the world is looking not just to us here, but to all of us. And when we understand that we can either be on the center stage of the greatest drama in the history of the world, or nosebleed seats in the fifth operatic column, well, of course, this is where we're going to be. So what kept the fire alive for me is the dreaming, the remembering, the thinking, the stories that I was told, the legend that Israel became, and the understanding that we are needed here. We are all needed here in the land of Israel. That's what really kept the fire alive for me. And not only that, just one last thing I want to tell you. I was in Gaza, I was in Lebanon, I was in the Golani infantry unit, and my mother wasn't able to sleep at night. And she really wanted me to return back. Once I finished the army, she said, please come back to America, it's so much safer. I go back, the second week I'm there, I'm walking down the street, and I was just stabbed in the back, the knife, into my back and into my arm. And the police said he needed to stab a Jew to get into a gang. And then I saw the World Trade Center come down before my eyes. I'm like, I gotta get out of this place. This country is crazy. And so what kept the fire alive for me is just the constant dying. It's like a new pair of shoes. That's what it is. You buy a new pair of shoes, it's exciting the first few days, and then 2 weeks later you're not thinking about it. In Israel, I had that new pair of shoes feeling, but literally every day that goes by, it gets more exciting and more dynamic and more of an intimate, loving relationship. And I'd say, how was the fire kept alive? From the first moment I was here, it was lit and it was inextinguishable. And I'm sure this is the same story with you.
I made Aliyah when I was 11 and never left.
Yeah.
There you go. Good answer.
11-year-old.
I personally was in college and at some point started going off the tracks a little bit. And what brought me back on the tracks... Thank you very much, Jeremy Kapow! He's a man! Karen, as you go out, thank you so much for being with us. And then there were two. I was saying that I was slipping off the tracks a little bit, as is my tendency, and what brought me back was Chassidut. I started learning Tzidkat HaTzadik. Somehow that book appeared, Ratzadik Mulden, appeared at my desk. And out of nowhere, I started opening it, and it just, every night, just boom, 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 just brought me up and up and back to Kedusha. Kedusha plucked me right back. I was always plugged into Eretz Yisrael, but I was just in a down place. And frankly, unlike what Ari says, I'm not of the Ari school on this one. I like New York City. I love it. I do. I love it. I love it when I'm there, and I think it's great. It's always attractive to me. I call it my Eshet Potifar. It brings me back. Come on. And I get the siren calls to me every time. I was just there. I felt the same thing. It's a great city to me. It's a great city, and I've been to very few cities that match up to it. Recently, I was in London, also a great city. I like great cities. I get attracted to it. I like the energy. That's why I live, by the way, in Jerusalem, because I love the energy. I love the pump and action of it. But at the end of the day, and I can't say that Jerusalem is a greater city than New York, per se. I can't say that. Ari can say that, because he's a good Jew. Not like me. I have a pintle of goy, you know? But there's a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and there's a Torah, and there's a truth. And when you're a person of, what's the word I'm looking for? Fierce, what's that? There's a word in English, I haven't remembered it today, like when you're really addicted to truth. Like, conviction is a good word. There's another one that I was looking for, like integrity. It's a question of integrity. And I also don't agree with Ari about the Galut in general. I'm a person who started an Aliyah organization, believe in Aliyah, but it's not because I think that the Galut is an illegitimate thing. I actually think it's part of Judaism. It's part of Judaism. Galut is part of Judaism. It's part of the story. The story of the Jewish people in the Tanakh is about Galut. The story of Yaakov Avinu is about Galut. Avram Avinu. There are people like Yitzchak maybe. But the thing is, I think we're living in a time period where God is calling us back home. This is the era of the Third Commonwealth. And Eshet Potifar is very nervous that you're going to leave her. So she screams even louder. It was only not so long ago that New York wasn't that pleasant for Jews. But suddenly now, it's so welcoming, so much well. It's like exactly the moment where we're supposed to go home. It's like, no, stay here. Five towns, it's great. It's just an amazing coincidence. At the very moment where we're supposed to go home, there's a sweetness, like a honey trap on the other side. So it's a matter of conviction and integrity, and it's a matter of understanding what time period you're living in. And it's also connected to Kedusha. The land of Israel wants to accept good candidates. And you get, you know, it's a very famous Rav Kook story and other stories that if you don't see the beauty of the land of Israel, it doesn't see the beauty in you. And it kind of shows, it's like the famous, you know, girl who didn't want to get married to the suitor, so she kind of dressed down and made herself look bad so that, like, he wouldn't be interested. It's the same thing. It's like Eretz Yisrael, when you love her, like, there's a beauty and a mystery and a knowledge that is so, nothing can compare it to, because it's the deepest truth. And it's beyond what we see with our fleshly eyes. It's something bigger than that. And that's the time period we're living in. All right, we're in the time. You want to comment?
Very briefly, I would be remiss if I didn't share a very powerful experience that happened to me on my last speaking tour. My first stop, you know, it was like this past speaking tour was very difficult because it was evangelical Christian group, Reformed Jews, Orthodox Jews, Lutherans. It was just like the entire spectrum of everybody, and I was sort of trying to think how to connect, but one of the first stops I was in New Mexico, and this pastor said, listen, there's a special meeting I want to have with our board. We haven't ever discussed this with any Jew before, but we read a little bit about you. We want to talk to you about it. He takes me, he tells me about this huge center that they've built, and it has hundreds of pop-out beds, it has an electrical generator, it has boxes and boxes and boxes of freeze-dried kosher food, and they said that when things get bad here for the Jews of America, that they're going to be hiding Jews here. Now we can say, okay, they're nuts. I've seen this in four different places now.
Wow.
That this has been shown to me in America, sorry?
That's like insane. Are they like keeping this secret?
Yes, they're keeping it secret. There's like a network of them that know each other, that have it set up in different places. I've been there. I've seen it. I'm telling you, I've seen it. So we can say they're nuts, but I'll tell you, when I was there in America was when Trump was elected. And I was in Oregon at the time, at a vegan bar in Oregon. And watching the people there, it was like they were watching a mini 9/11, or not even mini. They were consoling each other, they were weeping, the whole country was shaken up. I feel like the entire country, even though people that voted for Trump, Trump himself was like, whoa, whoa, thank you. He was the most shocked one, if you ask me. And why am I saying that? Because that sense of national shock, unexpected things happening, I believe that that is in store. That's in store not only for America, but that's in store for the entire world. I'm not going to act like I know how things are going to play out or what's going to happen, but I do believe that the Galut is coming to an end. I do believe that. And I'll tell you, I was reading Yechezkel, and I just want to read this, not in Hebrew, not abstract, just very clearly read to you what the prophet Yechezkel says. It says, "And I scattered them among the nations, and they were dispersed through the countries according to their way and according to their doings I judged them. And when they came to the nations to which they came, they profaned my holy name when men said of them, 'These are the people of the Lord, and they are gone from his land.' But I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel has profaned among the nations to which they came. And I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned amongst the nations, which you have profaned in their midst, and the nations shall know that I am Hashem." The Galut is a Chilul Hashem. It's a desecration of God's name. Now listen, I'm not saying that there's something bad if you were living there. Okay, it is a punishment that we, the Jewish people, had, and while we had to endure, we had to endure it. But we've been praying for thousands of years to come home. We don't need to be there anymore. Are we really going to go to the Tadavim and pray three times a day to return to Yerushalayim and we can do it, and we're not going to do it? Why? Why? I don't know why. But I can tell you that when there's a roof over your head and there's food on the table, everything is very abstract. But when there's an economic downturn and things get rough, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump until the fingers are pointed at the Jews. I don't think America is made of the same fabric that pre-Holocaust Germany is, but I do know that before the Holocaust, the Jews were more integrated and intermarried and higher in the sciences and the politics and the arts and the government than they are in America today. And it was still able to happen to them. So I don't know the way things are going to play out, but I do honestly fear deeply in my heart for the Jews of America, and I at this point don't care how it makes me sound. I feel like it's important to open the eyes of American Jewry and just allow them to know that we don't know what is in store, and this is the time to return to Israel. Not from that place. Not from that place. The reason to return to Israel is because it's the most dynamic, exciting, vibrant place on the planet. Life here is so rich and joyous. But there's also that to be aware of.
Okay, I just want to make two short comments on that. I certainly think it's a good warning that you're sounding, but I want to caution against your warning. Why? Because I think it actually leads to a false analysis, a false positive of the situation. The real danger of America is not a great wave of anti-Semitism. We have the disease in America. It's called assimilation. It's not anti-Semitism. So you got to shift. It's like you're kind of fighting the last battle, which is like the Holocaust. There's a new kind of Holocaust, the Persian type of Holocaust. Okay? Before Haman, it was like assimilation. That is where our people are. You go to California, you go to places, you see what's going on, dude. You can talk about these wackadoodles, and I'm sorry, they are wacky. I know those folks. Wackadoodles, okay? They come up with all kinds of things. They also think that the chosen land is in Minneapolis or something like that. The Mormons. They're crazy, you know. Like they have all kinds of crazy ideas in their head. They come up with a new crazy problem. The real problem in America is assimilation. That's what's going on. Who here has a first cousin who's intermarried? Who here has a first cousin that's intermarried? I do. That's the reality. And I'm just saying, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying you're kind of misleading people, because that's not the real danger. The real danger is the other danger of America, the Desh Potifar. That's the real danger, in my opinion.
1 second.
There you go. Sorry, I got the mic. That's the way it works. The other thing I want to say is I want to answer, what's your name again?
Sarah.
Sarah, I actually gave you that. I just want to give one more answer, which is a trick that we did in America. When my wife and I, we were married in 2002, and Hebron came back to for another year of Israel, of America, we would have people over every Shabbos. And we would be, maybe RIU or one of these dinners, Friday night. And we would be like, we had a kitchen that was away from the living room, from the dining room, and we'd be like, we have a very special dessert. very special dessert. And little did they know that we had little shot glasses. And these shot glasses we had purchased in the store right next to Yeshiva University, water from the land of Israel. Ain't getting waters. And we would fill these shot glasses with water. And we would come out to the living room and be like, we have water from the land of Israel. Make a bracha. Think about it. This is the water that Eliyahu and Avi drank. This is the stuff from the land of Israel. And people would get into it. By the time they took that shot of water, they believed. Right? One of the simple ways to keep yourself turned on to Israel, first thing, drink the wine of Israel. It'll keep you going. There's plenty of it in every store, wherever you live. The wine of Israel, the water of Israel, the beastly of Israel. I know Jews in Brooklyn, Hasidic Jews, who buy these spring drinks or whatever, these soft drinks, and when they pop the cap, they go, because it says in the Gemara, Avira, the Eretz Israel Machima, right? The air of the land of Israel makes you wise, so they like, pop it and get that first whiff of land of Israel air. Another thing to do is purchase a picture like this. Put one of these pictures in your house. It makes all the difference. I just get excited just to have them here. And that's you see that wall over there in the back? That's the view out my window where I live. But I'm like, wow, it's a great picture. I'm so excited to see Jerusalem. Like, put Jerusalem in your house. Like, take another step. Chazal made us say all these prayers and all these things. Like, put a photo. You know, we used to be like all upset about it. We used to put like we still do, leave a part of our wall unpainted. Okay, that's cool. That's the halacha. Also put on an awesome picture of Jerusalem. And see it every day. Let it talk to you. Let it talk to you. Like, do things. You know, put on music from the land of Israel. Musicians from the land of Israel. These things, they work. They keep us going. I produced a CD, which is called the Aliyah Revolution CD. Ari and I, we're in the cover. We're in the cover of the CD that I produced. I'm not a musician or anything. I gathered other musicians' songs about Aliyah. I should have brought it tonight. Dang it. In any case, I feel bad about that. In any case... You have a stash? I'd like to get that. In any case, do everything you can to fill yourself with that, with those energies. Go to make a YouTube playlist. Put on some Ofra Chaza. Chai, chai, chai. You know, put it on. You'll see. It'll bring you home. What do you... It's all you, buddy.
I appreciate you saying that, Yishai. You know, Chazal tell us, if the Jews don't make Kiddush, then the Goyim will make Havdalah. Okay?
Yeah.
I always say Chazal when I don't know who said it. So it's if the Jews don't make Kiddush, then the Goyim will make Havdalah. If we don't sanctify ourselves as Jews, then, and so Yishai, what you're saying is the main plague right now we're facing is assimilation. And that's true, but right when assimilation gets to that level where every other nation would just naturally disappear, well, that's when things turn in a very different direction. Now, I'm not sounding the alarm that the Americans are going to turn against Jews. I really...
You weren't actually describing these, like, chambers, right?
I was telling you what I saw there. I was telling you what they were telling me. But what I can say is that, you know, we're living in a time where there's nuclear proliferation. They're saying that there's this thing that's a very decent possibility. They're talking about it in Congress and in the Defense Department, where it's called an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse. Now imagine that this thing actually happens, okay? Where they detonate a nuclear device in the atmosphere and it shuts down the entire electrical grid. Things go bad very quickly. Where do you want to be when that happens? When I was here in Israel and there was a terrorist attack, I was at a suicide bombing my first week here when I was 18 years old. I was thrown to the ground. It was a triple bombing. And what I saw, that I've seen again and again and again, that is different than any other place in the world, is any other country, when a terrorist, when a bombing happens, you turn on the news, everybody's running away. In Israel, immediately, everybody's running too. Everybody is running too, because we're a family. And when things go bad, when something bad happens, whatever it is, even if all Americans are in danger, not just Jews, they're not turning against Jews, where do you want to be when that happens? And that's the point I'm making. I'm not trying to be some sort of crazy alarmist. I respect and understand, and I have the same reservations about saying that very thing. But if for some reason, I just feel this important compulsion to do it. And for some reason, I want to share this last story. When I was in New York, Times Square, I'm walking there and I see these black Hebrews. You know who the black Hebrews are? They're like dressed like the Kohen Gadol on the Day of Atonement. You know, and like I'm walking by, and they're like, you with that yarmulke on your head, you Jewish? I was like, yeah, as a matter of fact, I am Jewish. They said, one who acts like a child is childish. So one who acts like a Jew is Jewish. So whereas you are like a Jew, we are the Jew. And I was like, okay, checkmate, buddy, that was good. But really, I was thinking about it, and I realized we're not. That's one of the fundamental issues that we're really facing, is that too many Jews will say, I'm Jewish, as if it's just another one of the different descriptive things that describe us, rather than our foundational, fundamental identity. And that's why when they're attacking Judea and Samaria, that's where the term Jew comes from. Jew comes from Judah, from that's where Judea comes from. It's all the same thing. So when we understand our foundational identity, it's just a matter of time until we end up in Judea, in Israel, and we return back home. It's foundationally an issue of identity.
Fantastic. Still, I think Jennifer is more dangerous than the EMP.
Okay?
Yeah. Any case, last question of the evening. It goes to, I'm sorry that this lady's sitting next to you. Sorry about that.
Is it okay if a question maybe?
Yes, I can have some private.
Are we done?
Yeah.
So I want to thank you so much for a fantastic evening. It's been a lot of fun. And we covered a lot of issues, friends. Hey, before you go, I want to tell you that Ari and I are part of an incredible network called the Land of Israel Network, which has at least minimally a radio programming every single day from Israel. You asked Sarah, you asked the question about how to stay connected to Israel. Landofisrael.com, Land of Israel Network, thelandofisrael.network.com, thelandofisrael.com,
Land of Israel Network.
And we're also on iTunes and every other thing, so stay connected and stay in touch.
If you want to email me,